Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
This is AVXL episode 14, recorded May 4th, 2016. Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Heron.
And we have stuff.
Stuff. Well, it is May the 4th.
May the 4th be with you, ladies and gentlemen. I am delighted that my son is no longer afraid of the cantina scene in Star Wars. It's good.
I could see how that might be traumatic.
I also think after seeing the Force Awakens, my son has decided he wants to learn how to pilot planes. So,
excellent.
And he's starting to make noises like BB-8, so...
Excellent.
Three cheers to the revival of Star Wars.
I think I might have to break out my despecialized versions of Star Wars and watch them again for the holiday today. So
I'm going to sort those out to expose the boys.
I really appreciate the work that group did. A gentleman, I think, or a person named Harmy, and they put together basically edits of, basically crafted the original Star Wars with all of the best source material they could find.
Right.
And it's a pretty good result. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes. But if you've never seen it or you want to experience that original, view of Star Wars that's no longer available as it was originally released in the theater, this is a pretty good effort, I have to admit. And it's something I'm glad I have. So, and I'm glad they're making it. So apparently there is a new version. I had the 2.5 version of the despecialized Star Wars edition, and now it's up to 2.7 for one of the episodes, and I'll be curious to see.
Really,
I'll be curious to see what changes they did or what edits were made, and to see what potential improvements are to be had.
So many improvements.
Yeah.
So little time. LG's got their new E6 series HDR OLEDs.
Yeah.
You said the 55 inch arrived this week. The 65 inch is available. More affordable compared to the G6 series without the fancy folding base. Is the glass as good as the G6 series?
Should be identical.
Whoa. Hey there.
It's basically a design change. So it's just both are the G6 and the E6, the new 2016 OLEDs from LG, are using a glass back. Actually, a pretty sizably thick piece of glass at that. Two benefits, I think. One, LG went this route because it offers greater stability for the panel.
Sure.
So it in turn should improve longevity over the long term, of course.
Especially if you move a lot.
These are also their HDR compatible displays. So these are fully supporting all the latest and greatest features, including your Dolby Vision and your HDR10. And it has all the inputs for future devices like your UHD Blu-ray players and things like that. So it's I think 55 inch is almost too small, but I understand the price point's really good. I think it just hit, I want to say $3,000 for the 55 inch.
$4,000 for the 55 inch.
Yeah, and that's about $1,000 off list. So that's already come down a little bit. The 65 inch is still at premium pricing, I believe.
Well, no, it's at $6,000 now on Amazon.
Okay,
you save $1,000. That's 14%.
Nice. So good. Yeah, it's not only nice to see the new models out, but at slightly discounted prices already. And that should only improve down the road. It would be nice if somebody else was making OLED panels and there'd be a little competition in pricing. But currently LG's the sitting on their tech and enjoying, not a monopoly, but, it's their pride and joy.
Yeah. So I'm trying to remember, the G6, are those... Those are basically the high-end models?
Yes. Okay. And they have some other models coming out. I think the B models, the B6 series, and a couple others that will be out later that will be even more affordable. And chances are that probably won't be doing the glass back and other things like that. But otherwise, yeah, there's going to be some good OLED options for 2016. Still no sign of the large panels they keep showing off, though. The 77-inch in particular. Mm-hmm. We've seen it at trade shows. We've seen it in demonstrations. I see no sign of that in the retail channels yet, but
I wonder if they're having yield issues with the glass, or if they're just selling too many of the, like the 65 keeps selling out, or just didn't it just sell out again?
It may.
Or I should say, it's not again. It just like launched and sold out almost immediately.
It's a popular panel. I think so. And for everyone who's, especially for folks who absolutely love plasma picture quality, especially the last of the plasmas that came out that were offering decent brightness with superb black levels, this is a display that can really come close to matching that performance. Right. And you get the wide viewing angle like a plasma as well, which is another, you know,
nice.
For some people, that's an important aspect. So otherwise, there is, you know, there are more affordable options that do similar things in the LCD side from a variety of manufacturers, including LG and Sony and Samsung and Vizio. And, you know, so I think it's a pretty good time to be looking at the new screens. Although, again, if anybody is on the fence about this tech,
right.
Wait and see. You know, don't be in a rush. Content's still coming. Standards are still mostly done. And the hardware's still pretty limited.
There's only a minor battle for the formatting between, you know, HDR10, which you might know from UHD, and, oh, yes, Dolby Video, which is pretty much being used by all the streaming companies, although Netflix, for example, does both HDR10 and Dolby Visual?
Dolby Vision?
Dolby Vision, sorry, not visual. Brain fart there.
Very visual.
I have a four-year-old.
But it is kind of odd, though, that Samsung's the only company out with a UHD Blu-ray player right now. I mean, Sony just announced a whole slew of new products, including AV receivers, Bluetooth speakers, a new Blu-ray player that's 4K upscaling, and another Blu-ray player that's for premium audio support, but no UHD player. I mean...
There's something
It's striking me odd that Samsung's the only one with a player.
Does Samsung have some corner or some, I don't know,
secret sauce?
Some patent that nobody else wants to pay for?
You know,
the one that I would think. But
I will be traveling next week to the East Coast, and I will directly confront them with that question, and I will find out. So.
Oh my goodness! To jerk in an entirely different direction. If you haven't seen it, if you have an Apple TV, you should check out or an iOS device. Check out Earth Labs. It's from, and that's EARTHLAPSE. It is available on the Apple TV and iOS devices. But the best thing about Earth Labs on the Apple TV is if you haven't seen it, it is views from the International Space Station on your Apple TV.
Nice.
It has turned into this, certainly at least once a week, my wife or I are on there. And then grabbing one of the children to see, like, you know, the Aurora Borealis as shot from the International Space Station. They have a view out the window. The cupola that looks over the Earth is just absolutely incredible.
Now, could you get that in 4K on a Roku, maybe?
Well, it's funny you should mention that.
Or something, other box.
Props to a relatively new website called 4K.com, or relatively new to me, because they gave me the heads up, not on Earth Labs, but on the fact that NASA is now making 4K footage of the Earth and 4K stuff they've assembled from various other places available online. So, you know, for example, the latest one that was up on 4K.com that I saw was essentially footage of the Earth shot with a Red Epic Dragon camera, right?
That makes me happy.
Yeah. So those are actually available up on YouTube.
Space cameras.
Yeah. 4K crew Earth observations from the International Space Station. You know, that
should just be a 24-hour channel.
Well, they're working on
it. Yeah, they are.
They're working on it, right? Because if you go to YouTube.com, the NASA Johnson channel on YouTube.com, they are starting to do tons of video on there. For example, they just, you know, a moment with Oleg Skripochka, Jeff Williams, you know, talking about the physical science of station life, you know, an Earth Day view of Earth. You know, and they're short. They're like 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there. Space Station Live, Windows on Earth. Those are available all on the NASA Johnson's YouTube channel. But if you look at this video, you know, for example, ultra high definition 4K crew Earth observations, it is amazing.
I like it.
Yeah. You know, so it's kind of like this incredible PR effort by NASA being like, hey, we're still up there and we're still doing incredible stuff. And hey, we're going to share that with you.
That looks awesome.
Yeah, it looks pretty incredible. You know, and we're looking at it on this little 13-inch laptop screen. But one of the other crazy things they've done is a shot of, they call it thermonuclear art.
Nice.
And it is a shot of basically still images, in this case from the Solar Dynamics Observatory, which grabs a still photo every 12 seconds in 10 different wavelengths of invisible ultraviolet light as well as visible light. I'm quoting 4K.com here. And then they assembled that into a video you can watch.
Very
and
nice.
It's like a 30-minute video. It is crazy how cool this stuff is.
The sun is a pretty cool thing.
They did a similar stop action with the surface of, or I should say the visible clouds you can see above Jupiter. It's pretty cool. 4K.com, props to them for the heads up on that. And Earthlaps, if you have an Apple TV, you should definitely look for.
Earthlaps.
The other thing, some stuff that I thought was interesting is Time Warner is doing a web-only service, and I picked up this story off of Bloomberg.com, which is essentially Turner Classic Movies, which used to be about classic movies but is a little broader now. It's a new service called Filmstruck, but it's basically TCM and the Criterion Collection. And if you haven't been listening to Robert or I for a long time, you haven't heard us go off on one of our long-winded, or probably me, long-winded soliloquies of the joy of a Criterion release of a classic piece of film. For example,
Criterion is all about recreating that day of launch experience.
Right.
Going to find the best quality source material, but right. How was it presented and then originally?
Yeah.
No matter what the time or day of the original or the content is, and then make that available as accurately or as faithfully as possible to that experience of day one release. So if it was released with a stereo track,
right.
It's going to have a stereo track. And if it was released with blah, 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 it's going to have that.
In some cases, for example, the Easy Rider Blu-ray that Criterion dropped this week, I think it's got a DTS HD 2.0 and 5.1 soundtrack. And I guarantee you when Easy Rider came out, it did not, in 1969, it did not have surround sound or stereo.
No, but a good, say, lossless audio track,
right.
That as closely as possible recreates that original. That to me is just like it's good viewing.
Well, they're about getting the best possible visual experience. You know, Criterion Collection. If generally speaking, if it's a Criterion Collection edition of a movie, it's probably going to be one of the best versions of the movie you can get your grubby little paws on.
I don't seem to recall a lot of extras bundled with those discs either, which always made it kind of nice. So it's like, you know, yeah, just quit stalling. Get me to the flick.
Oh, my goodness. Well, so this is pretty cool, right? So Filmstruck, I'm quoting Bloomberg here, will feature a library of art house indie foreign and cult films, including Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, Robert Altman's The Player, which is a great movie, and the Beatles film A Hard Day's Night. It's commercial free. We don't yet know what the price of it is going to be. But it's also another example of how the diaspora of video is into services that require a monthly payment are slowly building back that $125 to $180 cable bill you ran away from. So filmstruck.com is the website, and you can currently sign up, drop your email to get an announcement for when that actually releases. But we do not have pricing information on that yet.
Coming soon.
Oh, my goodness. And, oh, yeah, Lionsgate. If you're not a gamer, you might not have noticed this. If you are a gamer and you have Steam, which is kind of redundant because I don't know a lot of PC gamers that don't have Steam these days. You know, Variety says Lionsgate is starting to do video distribution on Steam, including the Hunger Games film. Not necessarily any less or more expensive than some of the other places you can get the movies, but another opportunity for you to get.
They're bringing 100 films to Steam,
yeah.
Which is kind of cool. I mean, you think about the install base for that.
125 app. Million Steam users currently.
I'm one of them.
We both are.
And I haven't even thought about other stuff besides games
and applications.
I'm sure
the people at Valve have been thinking about that for a long time.
Apparently they have. That's pretty cool, though. Hey. If I have that app somewhere convenient and I can stream a flick there, hopefully it'll also support, you know, being able to get that onto other devices. Maybe they'll make a TV app or an Android app that I could use as well on certain TVs. So we'll see.
I'm not holding my breath on that one. Eh, but it would be nice.
It would be cool.
Oh, and while I'm on this tirade, Universal Pictures, we talked about the Star Trek, the pricey Star Trek reissues on UHD. What I didn't realize is that Universal Pictures is apparently going to deliver over 100 4K Blu-ray movies for 2016. Which is a lot more than I would have expected.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it's some of the newer titles that have come out recently as well. Get caught up.
Yeah.
Expand the offerings.
we will see. I think like the Jason Bourne films are going to be out. Warcraft, which I'm not particularly looking forward to, but I have some friends that are incredibly excited about the Warcraft movie. Lone Survivor, Lucy, Everest, we expect more to be coming.
So pretty much every major studio now has pledged or is currently delivering UHD Blu-ray movies except for Disney.
Yeah.
So Disney.
Well, Disney maybe not, but Marvel, who is essentially, a partnership owned by Disney.
Ah.
But, we may have mentioned this last week, but we're looking at like 100 hours of HDR. Ty Pendlebury wrote this up on CNET. So Netflix, Marvel's doing a ton of HDR stuff that's going to come out on Netflix. Like 100 hours in the near future, 150 hours by the end of the year. So, you know, Marvel's Jessica Jones, which I'm pretty sure I talked about last week, Adam Sandler's The Ridiculous Six, Chef's Table, Hibana, Marvel's Iron Fist, Daredevil. I'm also kind of excited that Amazon's going to be doing the Man in the High Castle in HDR, and a couple other movies. If you haven't seen The Man in the High Castle, man,
worth checking out.
If you've got Amazon Prime, go check that out. I'm just saying, it's
as happy as I am for the higher resolution, it's the additional, the greater expanse of color, more saturated, richer, literally a larger palette.
Right.
That to me is as important as anything.
4K is a great desktop resolution.
Yes.
If you're like more than 2 feet away from 4K in a living room, you really can't see the difference in terms of the pixel density.
Oh, that's
the
pretty
colors,
tight.
However...
Oh, I mean, I always think there's some perceptual difference. I mean, if you have, say, 55-inch TVs, one showing identical content, but one of them is showing native 4K and the other showing, say, Blu-ray, 1080p resolution. Most people are able to see that difference at about 9 feet away on a 55-inch screen. So, whether or not you can spot a line pair at X number of feet away at a given resolution, you know, that's one thing. But I think there's a lot of subjective detail that the brain just fills in and picks up and utilizes on these higher resolution screens when you're showing this kind of content. I obviously if you're sitting way far away, the point is moot, but for even, like I said, screen size is at 55 inches, and I want to say, who did that test I saw, and I really like the way they did the setup on it. Might have been Audioholics. And they did that side by side and had just random folks on two calibrated screens, one 1080p, one 4K. And the majority of people were able to see the difference in the content, even at 9 feet away. So
nice.
There's a lot there. And it's, you know, for me, it's the future proofing of these standards and formats, too. We need greater resolution, and we need containers that can do video in greater resolution with greater color. In particular, and other features, including, you know, more channels of audio or higher bit rates of audio. That's a relatively minor bit stream compared to the video side of it, but it's all there, and I'm looking forward to it.
As well, you should. Hey, what's going on with Netflix and VPNs?
Last night I have my TV set up as using an unblocker service, and apparently services like Netflix and others are looking to squash the fun of people using VPNs and unblocker services and things like that. I roll with a service called Unlocator that I use for watching my MLB baseball when I want and how I want, and it turned out that it popped up an error last night when I was switched over to Netflix, which I really don't need it for. I don't need my unblocker service for that, but it was all configured, so... So I go to the Unlocator website, and they go, hey, are you receiving odd errors with certain services? Blah, 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 blah. Well, we have a couple things to try. Basically, they have these beta locations now. Really? So I switched from being in the USA to USA-beta, and everything worked just fine after that for that switch. So, you know, be aware that companies would prefer you follow their rules, and they are they are going out of their way to ensure that, you know, if you are using some tools and if they can detect it easily enough, they disable your streaming and things like that. But I will say the beta update or the beta location change worked for me on Unlocator. They also had, if that didn't work, they had an even more extreme measure to take in terms of blocking specific IP addresses, which was kind of interesting.
Really?
So there is clearly a little back and forth and a little cat and mouse going on in terms of...
Seems a little excessive.
Yes. But I'm just glad the service that I have been recommending and using for quite a while now is actually seems to be on top of it and providing workarounds for anyone who might be experiencing issues. So there you go.
And the game of cat and mouse continues.
It truly does, and I doubt this will be the last straw, but... I'm happy to be watching my baseball. Local games, no blackouts. And
until the MLB starts blocking things out. Until you're singled out your IP address. Of course, then you just have to dump your IP address and get a new one assigned from Comcast's rather large pool of them.
Change your MAC address on your router. Change the MAC address on your router and then reboot your cable modem and boom. Suddenly, it's mysterious. You've got a new IP address.
Staring at your speakers right now or looking quizzically while listening to us on earbuds in your favorite subway and or bus to work, MAC addresses are individual, utterly, totally individual addresses assigned to anything it connects to the internet. Basically, your network port. Your Wi-Fi device inside of your laptop, your desk, or your Ethernet port, your Ethernet jack has its own discrete identifier known as a MAC address. Now, in some cases, companies will produce 1,000 of the same thing with the same MAC address. Oh. That tends to be like pen testing tools or really obscure stuff. If you bought this like over the counter, you know, and not say direct from China and or somebody who's creating tools to be used for network analysis or something, you have a MAC address. You can't change your MAC address. You can spoof your MAC address. But, you know, if a company wants to get really vicious about something, they want to start, you know, collecting MAC addresses.
I am happy, though, that you have that ability on most routers I've looked at least, to go ahead and change what its reported MAC address is to the connected source internet device.
Right.
So when that's done... it effectively acts like a totally new box to say a cable modem, and then it allows you usually to then be assigned a different IP address as well. I use it personally for just when I'm setting up a new device that hasn't even been connected yet, and if you know what the MAC address is, you can go ahead and, you know, put that in and then specify an IP address for it before you ever connect the device, and then so when you do, boom, it's set up just the way you like. And I use that for things like security cameras and other things as well. But
I'm in the process I have been for several weeks or months now of finally like redoing the home theater gear and the home network. And I think I'm just going to go static IP addresses on everything with the laptops.
I do that for hardware that doesn't move around.
Yeah.
And then I also, there's a couple places online. If you want to generate just a random but valid MAC address, it's like, I don't want anybody to have my device ID or device address. You can do that as well. And I'll see if I can dig up a link for that if anyone who's interested. But oh yes, the glorious MAC address.
So much potential
mayhem
to be had. Oh my goodness. We got a viewer question. You want to fire that one out, Robert?
Sure. At Thomas Sully tweets, at AVXL, at Patrick Norton, at Robert Heron, for episode 14, like this one, hey, I'd love to know the best way to listen to HD audio on an iPad. I'm taking it that there is no native HD audio support or an app that could deliver it?
Yeah.
That's a confusing thing for me because I've used iPads, but I've never really looked at like what audio chipsets are in there. Are they capable of doing HD audio? Oh, okay.
Well, you
think you'd be able to put an app to it
just
to have it do playback, maybe streaming at a high bit rate.
But, as complicated as iTunes has gotten over the last few years and messier and more difficult to use and just generally full of services that nobody asked for and didn't work that well anyway, they've never actually, you can't actually play FLAC. You can play lossless audio, but they want you to use Apple lossless.
Ah, well, that's so, okay. That's a cousin of FLAC.
A cousin of FLAC.
A close cousin.
You can convert between, like, you know, Apple lossless and FLAC, or convert your Apple, your FLAC files to Apple lossless before they're loaded on your iPad.
I used to back up my audio CDs. Once they were ripped, I'd back them up to FLAC, and then I'd also back them up to ALAC as well for Apple products, just in case, because I still had an iPhone, and it was the compressed audio size. It really wasn't 60 gigs.
Once you've ripped and encoded, ripped the ISOs for a couple hundred Blu-ray movies, the storage requirements of even lossless audio just look
compared to video.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's just, there's just not much there to store. Well, so, you know, if you want to play like FLAC, if you have a FLAC collection, you want to play FLAC on your iOS device, you can get VLC. We'll do it, actually, including the high-res stuff. FLAC Player is another option out there that people really, really like.
Totally. If you have an AVR, too, double-check. If it's a network-connected AVR, double-check its file support. Like, my Yamaha AVR supports FLAC playback. And I'm not sure if it does it over a network or not, but I have a USB stick full of...
But we're going to assume that Thomas wants to listen to his high resolution.
I said iPad.
Or on the iPad on the road, right? And here's the problem: is you physically don't have hardware inside of the iPad, or if you do, you don't have access to it.
That's true. I've seen you rolling around with that portable audio player that does it's high bit rate, high.
Well, basically, it'll play high-resolution audio. Yeah. So, you know, high-resolution audio or HD audio, it's a generic term. But basically, it's anything greater than sampling rates of 44.1 hertz and bit depths greater than 16.
Okay.
Now,
above CD quality.
Above CD quality. And the reason the very, very brilliant engineers chose 44.1 hertz and 16-bit depths is because that technically covers the entire expanse of human hearing, 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. And just to drop a little science for everybody out there, I'm not going to get into the argument over whether, like, you know, second, third, or fourth order harmonics mean that, you know, 100,000K, audio information at 100,000K will or will not impact your enjoyment of music, because that is just a hole down which there is no love to be found. But generally speaking, to get to the science part is, like, look, everybody obsesses, myself included, 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. And it's like, you know, part of the reason subwoofers for home theater systems go down, on the really expensive ones, go down to like 10 hertz or something like that.
A subwoofer. Good subs.
The very, very good subs.
Yeah, dude, 10 is ridiculous.
Because that's, you know, anything below 20 hertz, you're not hearing it, you're feeling it, right? That's that sense of being punched in the gut when something blows up on the screen.
I've been queasy in a room with some powerful subs and trying to test them out.
At some point it goes from being like enhancing to the experience to permanently scaring the snot out of someone.
Or have you ever been in an MRI machine and you feel that wave rolling through you and it's jiggling everything?
Sound is energy, people. Energy is force. So it's interesting. Like I got into a conversation with Jude over at HeadFi, and he said he doesn't really hear a difference between, you know, CD quality audio and, say, you know, 24-bit 192 kilohertz, you know, audio files, but he's willing to buy his favorite albums in that what some places call master quality audio, so that, you know, he has, for his own personal purposes, he knows that he has the best possible translation of that music. And I should also point out you need to be careful when you're buying certain high-resolution tracks, because in some cases the, quote, high-resolution tracks, unquote, are being sold at the high-resolution track store, but they are actually 44K 16-bit files, or worse yet. Well, in some cases, they're just the 41K 16 hertz files, which means you could have made that if you bought the CD, number one. And number two, in some cases, I don't think it happens as much anymore, but in some cases, there was some upsampling being done. For the most part these days, we're going to assume everything is fairly legit. But, you know, if you're buying, you know, high-def or high-resolution audio, it's available in FLAC. you know, Wave, AIFF, you know, DSD, which is Super Audio Compact Disc, which is so fringe and so fascinating. But I don't want to get into that right now because it's still an area where I
SACD
just...
and DVD-A support on that new Sony player.
Yeah, well, and the reason they're doing that is because people are stripping out the DSD audio from the Super Audio Compact Disc, and so they can play it in a portable you know, in a portable fashion. You know, so in some cases, you know, in some cases, people are saying like it's more like analog, it's more real, it captures more of the subtleties of the recording and the performance. You know, the there's also, you know, there's also some really big question marks as to whether you can hear it. Let's assume you just want to play the stuff back. I don't really care about your opinion, Patrick, which is perfectly reasonable, and I support that at all times. Always question. Always ask questions. So you're going to need, you're going to need something like VLC or the FLAC player. You're also going to need an external digital analog converter. And one of the things everybody found out a few years ago is
you mean for delivering it to a pair of speakers?
You basically can't get high resolution audio out of the headphone jack on an iPad or an iPhone for that matter. What you can do is connect one of the camera USB adapters to that device and then output. The digital signal will go out through
you know,
the connector into your external digital analog converter, which will then power your headphones, In some cases, there used to be like HeadFi used to have a big giant list of compatible HeadFi, used to have a big giant list of compatible DACs that worked with the iPad. But in later versions of the operating systems, pretty much all DACs started to work. The really big question is whether or not that DAC requires more power than your iPad will output.
Right.
You know.
Do you think this is something that Apple high resolution audio support will be adding to future iPads? Is that something that could be? Anything could be, I guess. But
well, I mean,
Is there a market there for it? Is there enough people who want it to make it worth their time?
Well, to paraphrase something a little snarky, I don't remember who it was, Bloomberg or Forbes, but somebody once pointed out that a lot of the advancements in audio and video have very, very little to do about the consumer's enjoyment of the video or audio, and a lot to do with whether or not that will cause people to buy more consumer electronics to replace the consumer electronics they already own that run just fine.
Uh-huh.
Now that may be a little, you know, mean of me to say.
Now I'm curious too, if they could add that to the Apple TV with its HDMI output. Possibly.
Yeah. You're also talking about the Apple that released the 1080p Apple TV with the TVOS.
Not holding my breath.
Well, you know, but somebody's like, why didn't they do a 4K version? I'm like, well, because they'll do a 4K version when they want you to buy a new Apple TV, and that's after they've straightened out all of their licensing and content
the
for
back
4K,
end, yeah.
Which, you know, in a lot of cases is you know, they probably know a lot about the kind of bandwidth the average, you know, Apple TV user has, and whether or not the average Apple TV user could actually watch streaming live or streaming from Apple's servers a 4K video. You got to remember, like, 4K video takes up a lot more space. Okay, with H.265, you know, it's so much more efficient, but you still end up with some big ass files.
I mean, even for streaming, they would prefer 15 megabit, and most of them I'm seeing now are in the 7 to 8 range at peak.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure they'll go higher. And when they start adding in the additional color support, I think they will be pushing closer to 15. So,
you know, in a related note, I thought it was interesting. Comcast has been doing their experiments with bandwidth caps, where they've been playing around with a 300 gigabyte cap and then getting people to pay additional money for additional bandwidth in, you know, I don't know, a dozen, two dozen markets in the U.S. They have actually decided that all of those experiments are being suspended, and you can now basically buy an unlimited, uncapped internet for, like, I want to say $50 a month additional onto your bill.
And they upped it in, I don't know if it's all markets, but they were talking about a 1 terabyte limit now. Or one terabyte? No.
Yeah, I should say, no, you're right. It's
But there is an unlimited cap above that for another fee. $30-$50, whatever it is.
Well, so the new cap, right? The theoretical new cap is going to be an additional 30 gigabytes. And we should point out, this is only for the markets they are testing in. The vast majority of the United States, possibly because they just don't want to piss off everybody in the United States simultaneously, which if you're Comcast is probably a really good idea. But they've been experimenting with a 300 gigabyte monthly cap, which is about 100 hours of HD movies on whatever service you're streaming. You know, what they're working on now is a 1,000 terabyte, or 1,000 terabyte, that would be awesome.
Yes.
1,000 gigabyte, a 1 terabyte cap, which is about 700 hours
That's
of
better.
HD video. Yeah.
I think as some people have pointed out, it would be best if they just simply drop these stupid caps altogether.
But they don't, because it's kind of like the cable boxes. There's a lot of money there. They're looking at, like, one, they're talking about a fringe, a very tiny percentage of overall users that are going to be anywhere near that. But what they were doing with their experiments was basically like, hey, you break the cap 3 months, we're going to, you know, give you a choice between paying, you know, by the gigabyte or paying an extra vig moving forward. So now unlimited data would be like $50 a month starting in June.
Additional.
Yeah. And Comcast has said like 99% of their customers don't come close to using a terabyte data. Like 8% of the customers used more than the 300 gigabyte data cap, which they haven't really been enforcing.
This to me just strikes me as their incremental approach to dealing with the Google.
Yeah, well,
inexpensive fiber that's being deployed everywhere slowly.
Yeah, right. Well, part of it was also, I think, was you know, when they did not get the merger they wanted last year, I think they also realized that while it may not be fair, that
although
so
they got
people,
it this year,
yeah, well. You know, they may feel that it's not fair that people hate the cable company. They may have also realized that they can do things to make sure people have fewer reasons to hate the cable company. So, you know, they're still playing around with data caps. You know, the total, like the 10 or the dozen or two dozen markets they're in is maybe like 10, 12, 15% of Comcast customers that are working on the data cap trials. But it is something, if you know, when you start looking at 4K, or if you have a, you know, if it's you and your four roommates in college and three of you are watching totally different things in three different rooms, the caps make it really interesting. In any case, this was all talking about Thomas Sully and his question about HD audio. And, you know, so what he will need is an external DAC. One of the easiest ones out there to work with is from I just closed the link with all the players on it. High Resolution Technologies.
Control Shift T.
Well, yeah, I just closed like 22 tabs though.
T. It remembers quite a few.
But they do their IDSP, which
cool.
High Resolution Technologies, they've been making really nice DACs for a long time, and they did the DSP and the IDSP. The DSP for Android and the IDSP for Lightning connector devices, and the IDSP is essentially the same DAC, but it comes with the USB connector, so the idea is what they did is the IDSP has very, very low power consumption, so that you don't need to go, because in a lot of cases you're going to have a, you know, your DAC, then a powered hub, and then connecting it into
the iPad, yeah,
you know, via the camera connector kit. So I should probably sort of summarize all this. So Thomas, like, one, you're going to need an application that'll play the high-res FLAC audio. VLC is a good place to start with that. You're going to need an external DAC if you already own one that's capable of playing high-resolution audio. And note that not all external DACs will play stuff higher than 16-bit 41K, so shop carefully. And then you need to connect that to the Lightning jack or the 30-pin connector on your iPad. So, you know, depending on the product, you may need to buy, you know, the camera connector kit with the USB and that external DAC. And if the external DAC sucks down a lot of power, you're basically not going to be mobile.
Now, what if somebody listening to this goes, well, I want to simplify this down to one product. Forget the iPad. And would you recommend a portable player? At a price point, or is using the DSP with the iPad a cost-effective way of doing it?
Oh man!
I guess, at this point, you're spending a little money no matter what. But
yeah, I mean that IDSP.
Would you prefer a portable player over that kind of a setup for home?
I've been using an Astelin Kern AK100 for a long time. Astelin Kern, they came out with the AK100 a few years ago, and I want to say it was about $600 when it first came out, and which is a lot of money. But it was also, you know, a standalone audio player that would do FLAC, that would do high resolution audio, that had just outstanding DACs, really, really good headphone amplifiers. And I've used it a lot, a ton, for audio testing ever
since.
I still have it. I still use it. Holds up well.
Nice.
You know, Astelin Kern started doing incredibly expensive stuff. For example, they're the ones that do the $4,000 like solid copper AK380, right? So they do a lot of incredibly expensive.
That's got some bling to it.
Yeah, you pick it up and I don't really consider it a portable anymore because it weighs like 3 pounds. It's a brick. It's a beautiful brick. It has wonderful interface. It sounds great, but it's a $4,000 brick. Happily, the other thing that they started doing recently, and I should probably get one in for review, is Astelin Kern started doing the AK Junior, which is kind of the heir apparent to the AK100 that I had. So that sells for about $500, which is a lot of money, but it's a really nice product. The interface is a lot nicer than on the AK100.
You know what? I'll see if I can, I'll ping Sony and see if they can send you the new player they have, their high-resolution audio player.
It would be fun to play around with that. I mean, it's been interesting, right? Because, you know, Sony's done one, Onkyo has done one, Astelin Kern's done one. If you're blanching at the idea of $500 for a portable audio player, and there's nothing wrong with that because that's a lot of money, it's a lot of CDs.
It's about half as much as the last iPad I bought.
Yeah.
So.
Well, what you can do is check out FIO, F-I-I-O. You're probably going to find them on Amazon. They've got a pretty nice web page now, too. But they do a high-resolution digital media player that starts at $100. If you are running like planar magnetic headphones that require all of the voltage in the world to drive, you're not going to be playing music loud with the FIO X1. But for $100, it's an excellent portable player.
I have these Sennheisers I got to bring in and show you just because I need to go get them repaired. I had a client give them to me because he didn't want to deal with it anymore, but they're either electrostatic or planar magnetic. I think they're electrostatic headphones.
Do they look like Kleenex boxes made out of punctured aluminum?
A little bit. And
they're
then
probably stacks.
It includes a decent-sized amplifier for this thing. And it's beautiful-looking, but it's going to cost me about $300-$400 to get them refurbished and repaired. But probably worth it. So I just... I just was going through my storage unit the other day and found more sublime gifts in there.
Does it have? Is it sort of a D-shaped black?
I'll
shiny...
take a picture of it. Okay, I'm gonna go over to my storage unit right after this and.
Because if
I'll
it's a Sennheiser Orpheus, that's like a $13,000 headphone/amplifier combination.
It probably wasn't cheap considering who gave it to me. It was this person didn't buy junk, but these aren't. They're older too, so right. It's kind of like cool tech. I just kind of like it's
if they're the big like rectangles on the side of your head,
yes.
they're probably stacks.
I'm pretty sure that's what it is, but I'll take a picture of it. I feel bad for not even knowing.
Those things are legendary.
That's what I'm thinking. I think I could be in. It's like it's worth spending. I think Sennheiser says they have like a fixed rate for fixing stuff, and I just what am I waiting for?
Take the picture.
Yep.
But.
Yeah. I wouldn't even, you know what, I should make a list of some of the stuff that's in my storage room. I keep I have a premium plasma. I have at least a couple TVs in there.
Right.
It's crazy. Anyway, off
no,
topic.
So, I mean, it's, the Sony A17 is supposed to be really nice. FIO's X1, the interface is a little funky on the FIO's X1, but the audio is really good. Sony's A17, I think, sells for like $300. There are a ton of options out there. I mean, because part of me is also, ever since I tested that the new Garmin's latest, GPS navigator. I started thinking like, there's something to be said for devices that do one thing and do it extremely well.
Yeah, don't require an internet connection to function properly.
Yeah. So Thomas, you can definitely get, you can definitely play high HD audio on your iPad, but you are going to need, download VLC and you're going to need an external DAC. Otherwise, you are not going to actually be able to physically play it back. So that's the upside is you can do it. The downside is you're going to end up with something or multiple somethings hanging off of the port. Like the IDSP is like $70. It's a good quality DAC. It's not a bad place to start.
Cool.
You're going out to Jersey to see the new Shiny.
Yes. Heading to Samsung's QA test lab in beautiful New Jersey. And this time around, I'm taking a look at the 9800 that was just introduced a couple weeks ago, the KS9800. I'm there to really just hammer on this set in terms of its color performance, how well that full array local dimming system works. This will be Samsung's only TV this year with a complete full array LED backlit local dimming system on an LCD.
Right.
Curved screen design, blah, blah, blah. But I'll be checking for things like blooming and halos. I want to really get into the peak brightness and the video processing. One of the bizarre things about all of these new HDR TVs is that there is a lot of code within the TV itself that analyzes scene by scene.
Uh-huh.
And it makes determinations in terms of how it should display the content. So it's really kind of at odds with the whole world of calibration in the sense that, well, is what the manufacturer decided to do with this particular scene the way it's supposed to be? Is it coming very close to, say, what it would look like on Sony's $30,000 1000 nit OLED studio monitor?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a target monitor a lot of people look at in terms of, can we come close to recreating that on our LCDs and our OLEDs and other things like that? So I'll be just enjoying that again. It's I did the 9500 a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago now, and this time around it'll be the 9800, and I'll be doing my thing, hammering away, trying to come up with any little quirks, and get those fixed and beautiful in time for people to enjoy the set in retail channels. So
nice.
Yeah, should be a good trip. I'm looking forward to it. And the weather will be warmer, although the last time I landed in New Jersey, it should have been in like the 40s, and it was 80, 83 degrees, and everyone was losing their mind. So
New Jersey, land of surprises.
I'm coming back.
Oh my goodness. usually we kind of start with some of the big stuff, but there is something, you know, Robert and I were thinking about that we want to get out in this episode is calibration hardware. And we've been getting a lot of questions lately about calibration hardware and calibrations and DIY calibrations. And, you know, you can do a calibration for free if you can find one of the, like Pixar had this sort of basic entry level, you know, simple, you know, adjusting the contrast and
totally. I was based off the THX. Those are test discs, really. Right. I mean, you really can't calibrate a TV using your eyeballs and a remote.
Right.
It requires a hardware meter to read what's coming off the screen.
Yeah.
The color, the brightness, the shade of gray, what color is that? If you don't have the hardware, you really can't calibrate a display. And I'm just going to say, period. What those discs like Spears and Munsell,
right,
the HD 709 disc on the AVS forums, free, or your THX test disc will do is show you that everything is correct. It's like, oh, okay, when I look at this grayscale setup,
right,
I am seeing the proper shades of gray from really dark detail, but it's not too bright. I didn't turn up anything to the brightest detail.
Right.
Oh, contrast is not turned up too high.
So if you run
scaling
this,
and things like that.
Run the Spears and Munsell disc, if you run the little quick check on the Pixar disc, it'll basically let you know you're in the neighborhood. Nothing's completely whacked.
But you won't be able to determine, like, what is the white point of the TV?
Right.
Is it D65 or is it too green, too blue? You can't really do that. I mean, granted, if you have a good grayscale comparison, you can optically look at you can look at a correct grayscale chart and match that up to your TV and go, you know what? Color gray is a little too red in the bright grays and a little too green in the dark grays. And those kind of adjustments really require a hardware meter. And if you're using a computer, the hardware meter can also generate, not only can it correct your notebook or your computer's display quality, but it can create a profile that is savable as a file that can be loaded up through the OS, and then that applies across the board. So, yeah, the test disks are great for either reference content or for just making sure your brightness and your contrast are at the right levels or that your sharpness isn't turned up too high.
Right.
For the basic controls, yes, okay, you can use it for that. But when it comes to making color adjustments or white balance adjustments, you have to have a hardware meter.
Right.
And that one I mentioned last week, or the last episode, episode 13, I mentioned one for about $250 from X-Rite. I like that one just because of its known quality and known company. Granted, you know, that's not exactly cheap, but maybe you and a friend could go in on it, and it's shareable hardware. I mean, you could, each could take turns with it and get a lot of use out of it. And
is
otherwise,
that the X-Rite One Display Pro? I mean, they also have the Color Monkey that sells for like...
See, that that's just an unknown to me. I haven't actually used that. I bet you it's fine for doing, say, a monitor profile, especially the bright detail. But when it gets into, if you also wanted to use that for televisions, that's where I'm more comfortable recommending the i1 Display Pro.
Okay.
And the software that's included, chances are, I wish I could get a copy of that, actually. I'd like to see what software that X-Rite includes. I know it's going to include software that will at least do that color profile that you can then save that file to a computer, in addition to being able to probably telling you what white point values are and things like that if you wanted to use it for calibrating an HDTV and beyond that. That might make a good video segment for us to do here soon. It's just going through basic setup, and then I can actually show you what the adjustments are that I make on a TV when you do a calibration and the most important aspects of it. I was looking at a plasma, 2011 D-Series D8000 plasma from Samsung. Client had it. I was over there. They had another calibrator over who used a lookup table box, and I'll be honest with you, I want to spend some time with that lookup table box, but the end result was just messed up. It made pretty charts, but when it came to looking at the actual picture, there was green was missing, number one. There were some very distinct issues with the setup, so we could rip the box out of the way, ran through it, and then I had to almost relearn how to calibrate a plasma again. And one of the big things I discovered is on any TV, really, if you do have the hardware meter, you have to test every setting and to figure out what the best setting is. In my case, I was looking at the color space setup. It had an auto mode, which generally does a pretty good job of detecting between standard HD Rec 709 color versus, say, a wider color gamut. This had an auto and a custom and a wide setting. And I thought the auto was okay, but I noticed that when I plotted the color points out, they were a little weird. And then it turns out that the TV's custom mode at default values was practically perfect. So that is where another example of where a hardware tool really could say, you know what, the auto mode, while okay, is no comparison to that custom mode just left at default values. And that was a... that was a good reminder for me. And it was, and in the end, that TV came out looking damn good, I must say.
Nice.
as a plasma that's probably, what, 5 years old now?
Yeah.
It still looked pretty good, so.
It's nice that things age well.
Yeah.
Although they do age.
And they can burn in. If you're a sports fan.
Phosphor decay. What is the phosphor decay rate for a plasma?
I don't know, but I've got an Oakland A's score ticker on my permanently burned into my plasma. Not permanent. I just need to run. need to run non-sports video on my plasma for a few days to wear out the clear OAK symbol for Oakland A's baseball.
You're a baseball fiend, Robert.
I've now restricted my baseball viewing to an LCD television. So,
oh my goodness.
I thought that was pretty funny, though.
That gets expensive after a while.
Good golly. Have we talked enough?
I think we've talked enough. Hey, one last thing before we go. We're going to schedule our first. We owe you guys, especially our patrons, patreon.com/AVXL. If you contribute there, a buck a month. You got a buck a month for this show. Make it happen. You know, we're picking up new listeners at a surprising and delightful rate, which is awesome. So do us a favor, keep telling your friends. If you get a chance to review us on iTunes or any other podcatcher or location, if you could send us a kind word or give us a thumbs up, that would be hugely
helpful.
Will
we be be bringing the show over to Google Play soon.
In the process of doing that, basically you ask to be put on Google Play, and then at some point in the future, you get a confirmation email to verify that you own this podcast. And then once you verify that you own that podcast, you have an unknown amount of time before they go, cool, we reviewed your claims that you own this podcast in the RSS feed, and we find it acceptable. And then it shows up in the Google Play Store. So that is
Google Overlords approve.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
Hey, it's a process.
It's a process. I was about to make a Jon Snow joke, but I don't want to do.
I don't even know who that is.
You know, he's not a hobbit, therefore you shouldn't
not
hate
a
him
hobbit.
Immediately.
Thank
Haven't
goodness.
You watched Game of Thrones yet?
No, we not a, not an that. Episode. I did finish Lost. Is that still on? No.
It's always nice to see.
I'm actually I started finishing season one of Better Call Saul.
Nice.
And that's in 4K streaming on Netflix, and it looks fantastic. Netflix has a lot more 4K content now, I've noticed. So,
oh, my goodness. What was it that I fell in love with? Oh, I finally got to see Deadpool.
I am so looking forward to watching that. Hopefully, they don't even need an unrated director's version. I think it was R-rated in the theater. So.
It better have been.
That I think, is just going to make me smile watching that. So,
oh, man.
Looking forward to that one, too.
It's nice.
So many good movies I haven't watched.
Oh, my goodness.
Caught up.
It's a good thing.
Watching
yeah.
too much baseball and Formula One.
Deadpool. Yeah, I should say I'm actually halfway through Deadpool. There is a 1 a.m. toddler wake up that precipitated the end of the, you know, if you're not familiar with Deadpool, the comic book, you really don't understand exactly why I turned the screen off as quickly as I did when the year old wandered around.
But oh, I can't wait to find out.
It's awesome. It's super,
Daddy,
super
what's
awesome.
That? I don't need to explain this.
I can't remember. Is this a family-friendly podcast or not?
you don't have to explain it.
Well, when a superhero and no, I'm not going there. The but in any case, we owe our patrons a hangout. We're going to be doing our first patron hangout and our first patron movie hangout. We're going to get this scheduled.
We're just going to do it, or do we want ideas for that, or should it be whoever?
Well, if
attending?
You guys have themes, whoever's attending, I think, is going to have questions.
Yeah, oh, that's true. It'll be Q&A and stuff. So.
Yeah, I mean, we're also working on a movie based hangout. And
oh yeah, all right.
Because we like movies. You may not have picked up on that, but we really like movies. You know, it may not be obvious given the baseball obsession by my taller friend across the table here.
It's such good background noise. I work so well when there's a ball game on in the background.
Well, you know, we will send out everybody's pledged high enough to do the monthly Google Hangouts and the every other month Movie Club Google Hangouts.
Oh, sweet.
We'll get emails out to you shortly with dates for that. And if you have suggestions about, you know, whether it's better in the morning or in the evening or the weekends or during the week, do us a favor. Email us with any and all of your questions about home theater and headphones.
Please
and music
do.
And video and streaming and satellite and mayhem and superhero dating advice to ask@avxl.com.
So. I've been getting the show, as soon as it's edited, I make it available to the Patreon listeners, all our supporters. I post a link there if they want to download it and start listening early, because it usually takes me another day or two to get the webpage right and get all the other crap lined up.
If we can get 73 of you to donate just pennies an episode,
telling
we can get our video
a candy
rolling.
Bar a month.
A candy bar a month. For less than the cost of a single Frappuccino.
Oh, please.
Or if you want to give us, you know, the equivalent
brew your
of a Frappuccino
own
a month. Oh, my goodness. In any case, before we get too silly, heroinfidelity.com is a place to find Robert Heron. You can find me at techthing.com, the show I do with Shannon Snubs Morse. That's a technology show, in case the name didn't suggest that. And as always, at Robert Heron or at Patrick Norton.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, so much. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Heron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.